Let me start by admitting that tonight's readings terrify me. From the Hebrew Bible, we heard that the Lord threw the Egyptian army into panic, and they decided to flee. But before they could get away, the Lord ordered Moses to stretch his hand out over the sea so that the waters would return. And then the Lord tossed the Egyptians into the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the chariot drivers, the entire army of Pharaoh. Not one of them remained. And the Israelites saw the dead bodies wash upon the shore. Then in the parable from Matthew's Gospel, we heard that a slave who was forgiven an unimaginable debt, but then fails to extend forgiveness himself, will be handed over to be tortured until the debt can be repaid. And then Jesus said, "So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart." So in the first text, God is a murderous force who destroys an army even while it's running away. And in the next, God is a fickle sadist who one moment forgives, and yet in response to our weakness, whisks that forgiveness away and sends us away to be tortured. And I don't know about you, but these images of God terrify me. Of course, many Christians are happy with the image of God, the mighty warrior fighting for righteousness' sake. And such language is often used to shore up Christian support for war. And we can watch this, I'm sure, in the next few weeks play out in our national politics. But other theologians are troubled by such imagery and have attempted to explain the violence. Some justify God's violence in Exodus as a necessary consequence of oppression, although this skips over the way the liberation of the Israelite people led to the genocide of the Canaanite people. Others suggest that the violence should be understood as God's anger at the military violence of empire, since it's the chariots or the armoured vehicles, the tanks, the Hummers, which are particularly and repeatedly mentioned in the text in that chapter of Exodus. Still, other scholars suggest that the event never happened. Despite its obsession with records, the Egyptians never recorded the major news of the escape of a nation of slaves, let alone the destruction of its entire army. And this suggests the story is a tale told by a band of escaped slaves. And it tells us what they wish had happened and how much they hated their oppressors. Most of these are useful ways of understanding the violence, and most of them contain some truth. But there's still another way. But before I talk about that, let's turn to the text from Matthew. It begins with Jesus saying that we need to forgive 70 times 7 times. That is to say, countless times. And then he tells a story. And in the story, someone who's experienced forgiveness and yet fails to extend it to others will be handed over to be tortured. And so too will it be with us if we fail to forgive. But how is this possible? First, Jesus tells us that we need to offer forgiveness over and over and over again. And then he suggests that if we fail to forgive, God will retract the forgiveness once shown to us and send us away to be tortured. Surely this is contradictory. And I think the nub of the question lies in who does the torturing. If it is God, then we do have a violent God who punishes those who fail to live up to God's standards. And since we all fail time and time again, this is absolutely terrifying. We're all destined to burn in hell. But if, on the other hand, the torture is about the natural consequences of our choices, and then the text might make a bit more sense. If we take a step back, the text is part of something bigger, the book of Matthew. In chapter 7, Jesus urges his followers to judge not that you not be judged. For as you judge, so too will you be judged, and the measure you give will be the measure that you get. Likewise, tonight's parable suggests that if you choose to keep track of the debts of others, so too will you be held to the debts that you incur. We're already forgiven, loved, and free. That much is clear. We can embrace this and extend it to others. But if we turn our backs on this forgiveness, this love, and this freedom, then we find ourselves no longer free, but trapped in cycles of retaliation and hatred. And that is the road to hell. It's not God who wields the torturer's whip. God doesn't delight in our shrieks of agony or our groans of loneliness and pain. Again and again and again, God offers forgiveness to us, but it's up to us to accept it. And it's when we refuse the gift which is so freely extended, that we choose to live in hell. In the same way, the Exodus story might be seen as a story about what the Egyptian army did to itself. Perhaps God did not mete out the punishment. Instead, perhaps the soldiers drowned because they insisted on pursuing the Israelites, despite all the warnings and all the plagues that had been sent to Egypt, despite all the ways they'd been told that the Israelites must go free. Instead, the soldiers followed the Israelites, even into a boggy seabed. Of course the heavy machines of war got stuck. Of course the sea came back. That's what the sea does. And it drowned them all. But in the coming days and years, as the story was told and retold by the Israelites, the ones who were left alive, the tale got bigger. The destruction of the Egyptian army was seen as a sign of God's action on behalf of the Israelites. And so God was said to have actively drowned a lot of them, even to the point of tossing the Egyptians into the sea. Yet even in this telling, even in this story, there are traces of a different version. Because God keeps the Israelites and the Egyptians separate from each other, placing the angel of God and the pillar of cloud between them. God sows panic among the Egyptians so that they decide to run away. In other words, there are signs that God protected the Israelites just by keeping them separate from the Egyptian army and then by encouraging the Egyptian army to run away. Perhaps these are hints of an older story, a truer story, of a God who sidesteps violence and finds a peaceful way. I don't know for sure. This is only one interpretation, and some of the other explanations I offered earlier have truth in them too. But as Christians, we're called to understand God through the lens of Jesus Christ. And by him, we're told that the measure you give will be the measure that you receive. Violence leads to more violence. The Egyptian army was so reluctant to let the Israelites go free that it trapped itself. And then this army of a violent nation, which had inflicted so much violence upon its slaves, suffered violence in turn, not of God, but of the sea. I wonder what would happen if this interpretation was taken up by the leaders of nations. Do we meet violence with military intervention or with peace? It would be nice to think that the military interventions we engage in are neat tactical strikes, which take out the evil people and leave everything and everyone else intact. But I hope that none of us are that naive. Violence is messy, and almost all deaths in modern wars are women and children. The price that they pay for our righteously liberating action is unimaginable to us. More easily, we might be able to imagine that even we pay a heavy price. Our soldiers come home profoundly traumatised. Young men and young women scarred for life by the violence they've experienced and the violence they have done to others. Many are unable to re-enter the workforce. Many come home with drug and alcohol addictions. Many take their own lives. And the devastating impact this has on their families and our communities is just immeasurable. That's the human cost to us. Doesn't even take into account the economic cost. And meanwhile, the cost to those that we're going to save is much, much worse. We just need to think of the wreck that is Iraq. It was a terrible situation, but it was Western military intervention that left a power vacuum, the power vacuum which is now rapidly being filled by the Islamic State. I'm not saying that we should never intervene, but I'm to be convinced that military intervention leads to peace. Violence is a road to hell, for those who will be bombed, certainly, and also for us. I wonder what would happen if violence was met with bread and with blankets, with hospitals, with forgiveness of debts which place so much pressure on the economies of the developing world. I wonder what would happen if people were lifted out of the radicalising climate of poverty. What would happen if violence was met with kindness, the kindness that we see among some Israeli and Palestinian families even now? What would happen then? These are big questions about violence and forgiveness. But we also need to look at our own lives. And to illustrate that, I'll tell you a story. I know it will shock you all, but a couple of times a year, just once or twice, my husband and I have a big fight. And we had one last week, rather fortuitously, for preparing this sermon. Yes. Well, both of us. He said things he shouldn't have, and I said things I shouldn't have, and it ended, as always, with me telling him to go to hell, and with him going there. He left the house. I don't know where he went. It's not my business. But I am pretty sure that he was in hell. Because for a deeply uxorious family man, uxorious means wife-loving, there is nothing worse than being estranged from your wife and your kids. And from knowing yourself to be intemperate and reactive. Meanwhile, at home, I can guarantee I was in hell, unforgiving and unforgiven, wondering what had happened to my good husband, and confronted yet again by my own foul temper. I felt sick and weepy and alone, despite my children and my sister and all the others who came to my house. I thought of all my dear friends who've been divorced, and I wondered if this is how it starts. And if that's not hell, I don't really know what is. My husband finally came home and we found a polite truce. And it wasn't until the next day that real forgiveness was possible from either of us. And that forgiveness was a very deliberate decision and hard to carry out. But when we finally got there, I at least felt a sense of freedom, a renewed connection. My husband returned to me, and I hope that he felt similarly. And I'm telling this story because I want to emphasise that our time in hell was not a punishment from God. It's just a description of how it feels to be estranged from one another, when we cannot find either the courage or the humility to forgive. But we have to forgive, because God has already forgiven us. Being forgiven, being loved, is our starting place. If we choose not to live under this forgiveness, under grace, then we consign ourselves to the tortures of hell. But if we accept it and extend it to others, both as individuals and as nations, then we might experience this wide-open freedom and the intimate connection that are part and parcel of forgiveness. We all find it difficult to accept forgiveness and to forgive. It's not the normal thing to do, and that's why human history is so filled with stories of violence and retaliation. But forgiveness is at the heart of our calling, and Jesus shows us the way. Not seven times, I tell you, but 70 times seven. Forgive them, Father, for they do not know what they do. In a couple of minutes, we'll use one of the tools he gave us and pray together, Forgive us our debts as we forgive the debts of others. It's a daily reminder of our calling, a way of shaping our expectations and our behaviour. It's the prayer I needed to help heal the rift with my husband. It's a prayer our nation could use as we seek ways to answer violence, not with yet more violence, but with love. Violence, retaliation, revenge. Countless voices justify this pattern with cherry-picked stories of a violent God. But these stories are part of a much wider picture of salvation, in which we're liberated from this cycle. The one that we follow bore the wounds of our violence on his own body, but he cried out not for revenge, but for forgiveness.